What's up, everybody? Welcome back. Listen, here's the deal. I'm going to start this way. We're having some technical difficulties. I know that's hard for y'all to believe, but it does happen sometimes doing this here program live. We have some issues at times. This one, I think what's happening is, I don't know if y'all have heard, but Facebook is having issues today, technical issues. My wife has been keeping me up to date. She stays up on Facebook problems. And we think maybe that's given us some issues with our stream. We really hope that's not the case and that maybe now it'll be fine and we won't have any more problems, because we've got a great show for y'all tonight. We got the authors of the hotly debated new book, White Rural Rage, Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman, joining us a little later. So hopefully we get our damn shit together. Either way, I'm Trey. That's Mark. Mark, let's try to start again. What's up, man?
Yeah. Do you want to act like we just didn't do the first 2 minutes of the show already?
I guess so.
So some quick things to get through before we get to the show. A lot of news happening. It's Super Tuesday. I voted. Trey's a bad citizen. He hasn't voted yet. I just want to say I'm a good person. Kristen Sinema announced she's not no longer running for re-election. The candidate atop the Republican ballot for Missouri Governor, Daryl McClanahan III, said he was only an honorary member of the KKK. So take that for what it's worth. The Florida State Senate passed a bill to that would remove local government's authority to adopt heat standards, such as guaranteed shade and rest breaks for workers. So basically, if we can't get around to deporting you, we can give you heat stroke, as that's the official policy of the state of Florida. Putin plans to weaponize deepfake porn against Western democracies. My thing is, you know the AI is going to fuck it up. So what do we get first? Joe Biden the babysitter or Joe Biden the MILF?
Yeah, well, are you familiar with Rule 34, Mark? You ever heard of Rule 34? That is an internet maxim that states that basically any scenario you can envision has a existing porn version of it or take of it somewhere out there on the internet. Some sort of smutified take on whatever you can come up exists already. So if they ain't already got Joe Biden as a MILF, you know, just give it time. The technology is there. We have it. We can do it.
So what you're saying, there's probably a porn somewhere about Vladimir Putin making deepfake porns?
Yeah. Very possibly. Yeah. You know, I know for a fact that there's a written porn of me, Corey, and Drew, the well-read guys, fan fiction about us, you know, railing each other and stuff. So, you know, it's out there. I bet you probably got some. We could look deep for it. But anyway, go ahead.
You've done my buddy Brian Cook's old show, Competitive Erotic Fan Fiction, right?
When you yeah, I did. That. Yeah, I actually won the episode that I was on years ago.
Yeah. Supreme Court, so in two separate decisions, one putting Trump back on the ballot, the primary ballot, Colorado, but yeah, everywhere. And they also interfered in his prosecution in a way that just basically delays his trials. So they probably can't happen before the election. And there's not wondering what the logic is because there's a higher law than the Constitution. And that is the rule that Donald Trump is our special little guy. And that's basically in the Magna Carta that goes back to way before.
Seems to be the case. It seems to be trending in that direction. Yeah, he got his own constitution with porn stars and bullshit in it.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this Trump Bucks thing for a little bit. So there was NBC had this report out about this new scam that's being run by somebody, not Trump as far as anybody can tell. What they do is they sell memorabilia called Trump Bucks, but basically they treat them like it's real currency. For $999.99, you get a $10,000 Donald Trump Buck, which you should be able to redeem. Well, in the fine print says it's just memorabilia, but the promise is you can redeem it at banks, retailers like Walmart, Costco, and Home Depot. So for $100, $10,000 is a hell of a return. This one guy named John Ammon, who 77-year-old guy, is a Trump supporter, said he bought $2,200 worth of Trump bucks and realized he got burned when he tried to deposit them at a bank. So,
dude, my God, bro. What? Mm. Like,
I would rather imagine you're the bank teller. Like, I would rather have somebody hand me a note saying that I'm being robbed than me have to explain to this poor old guy how he got taken for $2,200. Right.
It really is kind of a genuine insight in the way their brains work where Trump is concerned, that they think that like Trump bucks is, you know, legal tender that will be accepted everywhere that you buy that. Like, that's so crazy to me, but it does make sense coming from his cult. I suppose that's wild.
I mean, part of what we're going to talk about today is rural and MAGA people's distrust of like the economy, and it sort of manifests itself. There's like other like conspiracy theories about how Trump's going to destroy everyone's debt and all this stuff. But like, I do want to say that this guy Ammon, like, he did everyone a solid by coming forward, because he looks like an idiot, but he's trying to get the word out to keep other people from getting scammed. So I'll give him that much. But this funny quote from him says, talking about Trump and the scam, said, I'm questioning whether he's aware of this. As if Donald Trump would care about somebody getting scammed.
Right. Like, that's Trump, his whole thing.
Belief. It's like, it's immoral to let a sucker keep his money. Right.
Right.
Anyway, NBC tried to reach the Trump campaign. They couldn't get any response about this. The genius of this scam, every time I hear about one of these scams, I'm sort of mad at myself for not thinking of it. Because, like, these are like securities, so it's supposed to take a while to mature or whatever. So people won't even realize they're scammed to go to try to deposit it like a year or two later, in which case you're already in the Caymans with their fucking money. But one of the reasons that ways they were pushing this, if you have this artificial intelligence Elon Musk video, Matt, like, watch this and see if any part of this, like, if any part of you could ever believe this is real.
Need to know this. That troop certificate is not a joke. It's real. And everyone need to get as many as they can. I spend $1 million on troop certificates. And this week I'm going to cash out my troop items. Soon I will be the richest person on the planet again. Need to know this. Right.
That's,
I mean, I would not believe it coming from him. You know, I would not believe that he said something that stupid. You know what I mean? But
no, he is stupid. Like, he lost a bunch of money in Dogecoin. But I'm saying, like the lips don't even match the words.
No, you know
what
I'm right?
Saying? Like, yes, it's like, right, no. Yeah,
yes.
That reality. That's footage from a TED Talk in 2022. The funniest part of this: this woman talked to NBC about how her mother-in-law fell for this shit three different times. The first version was like when I talked about the other you know, scams about having to do with like conspiracy theories and money. One's called Nassar, we might have talked about before. But it basically, that Trump's going to do a radical reset of the entire U.S. economy and all debt's going to be wiped out. And so she bought into that the first time and took out a bunch of debt, thinking Trump was going to get rid of it. That didn't work. Then she bought a bunch of Trump bucks. So this woman drove her mother-in-law to a bank to try to get her to try to deposit it to show she'd been fucking scammed. And then she did that, and she realized the mother-in-law admitted that she'd been scammed. But then her conclusion was she had just bought the wrong Trump bucks. So she bought a different version of the same scam. It's like, Jesus Christ, man. Like,
yeah. I got scammed by somebody selling fake Trump bucks. I was looking for the real Trump bucks, and I got taken by a con man. It's like, yeah, you did. Either way, you did. All right, let's get into it again. We got an exciting show for y'all tonight. We're going to welcome Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman a little bit later. But first, I want to let y'all know about a couple quick things. Matt, I'm going to do this real quick. If you want to see me do stand-up live, go to treycrowder.com. Check out my upcoming tour dates. We got plenty coming up soon in the future. I'll be in D.C. and Northern Virginia this weekend, so come see me. And also, if you want to support this show, you can do so by signing up on Patreon. Go to weeklyskews.com/more, or just go on Patreon and look me up. You get two extra full-length bonus episodes a month for $5, and so you get some more skews in your life and support the show in the process. Now, before we get to our esteemed guests, very, very shortly, let's first begin, as always, with the Daily Dumbass. Matt, graphic, if you could, please. Yes, it's a professional show we got here. He's gonna put it right in a little later. Anyway, our DD tonight is anyone who thinks Trump could name a second black hero. Listen to this. This is wild. He's talking about North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson.
Being here. But, you know, I heard him coming in on the plane. I was listening, and I said to the people on the plane, watch this. This is Martin Luther King on steroids. Okay, now, I told that to Mark. I said, I think you're better than Martin Luther King. I think you
are. All right, you can cut it, Matt. So Mark Robinson's the front runner to be the Republican nominee for governor of North Carolina. If you can't tell from what Trump's talking about him, he does happen to be black, but like the idea, he's calling him MLK. I want to read some quotes here, and you tell me if any of this sounds very Martin Luther King like. There's a time he called school shooting survivors, quote, media prostitutes, end quote, for advancing gun control policies. He posted a meme mocking a Harvey Weinstein accuser. Harvey Weinstein was a huge Democratic donor, so I don't know why they feel the need to defend Harvey. I mean, I know why, but it's a whole other thing. He made fun of women for wearing poor dresses to protest sexual harassment. He predicted the rising acceptance of homosexuality would lead to pedophilia and the end of civilizations we know it. He talked about arresting transgender people for their bathroom choice. He says a bunch of anti-Semitic shit. He put one on Facebook and called Hillary Clinton a heifer and Michelle Obama a man. And the thing about this primary is, like, there were other Republicans running to try to stop him. But they were trying to, they were complaining about the National Party abandoning them to leave them to fight this guy. But it's, as always, it's not clear whether they actually have a problem with his hatefulness or whether it's just, you know, bad for business in a swing state.
Right.
But their problem here is people say it's fake news when you tell them the stuff this guy said. There's like this weird thing in Republican primaries where electability doesn't matter because they don't believe any criticisms of their favorite candidates. Mm-hmm. The reporters tried asking for his supporters about one of his most scrutinized Facebook posts, which is a 2018 screed against the film Black Panther that references Israeli currency and uses a Yiddish slur for black people. And a guy said, "I can't help but think that's been manufactured by some opposition." The post is still accessible online. You can still go look at it on his Facebook page. Like, he basically said, he talked about it in Black Panther. He doesn't understand how people can get so excited about a fictional, a quote unquote, hero created by an agnostic Jew and put to film by satanic Marxists. You ever seen the movie Face in the Crowd, Trey? The Andy Griffith
with
movie?
Andy Griffith.
He's basically like this, sociopath who rises to become like the face of like a real America, becomes this like superstar, like broadcast. Anyway, he gets caught talking about his supporters being idiots on a hot mic or whatever. Then his career falls apart and says, "I'll be back." And you know, it will, because it's a pretty, for a 1950s movie, it's pretty prescient criticism of media, of modern American media culture.
Right.
So this guy was a nobody in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what I mean. Like, he was just like regular people aren't important to somebody. He wasn't in politics. He was working in a factory and just posting right wing Facebook screeds like the one I just mentioned. And he's sort of like a bizarro version of you in a lot of ways, because what happened was he had a viral video where he was just at I think was it Charlotte, whatever town he's from in North Carolina. I went to the city council meeting and railed against and the idea of gun control after the Parkland shooting, and it went mega viral. And he was invited to speak at the NRA convention. It was Greensboro City Council meeting. Sorry, he's from Greensboro. The NRA put him in a commercial, and then 2 years later, he was lieutenant governor of North Carolina, and now he might be governor.
Right. This is another good example of how much better it is if you are you know, sociopathic and lacking all scruples to be on that side of the like viral fence. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think that Democrats would elect me to shit, because they would be like, "Well, he's not actually smart. He couldn't do that." Right. But this dude, he yells in his truck and they're like, "We need him in the governor's mansion." You know?
Right.
And then he ends up there. So.
No better, honestly, that's a good way to describe it, because there's no better, like the difference between being successful on the left and successful on the right is, like, you go viral and you're like, "I'm going to be at Chuckles this weekend in Cincinnati." And he's like, "I'm going to be the governor of North Carolina."
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Honestly, yeah, sorry. If they're here, we go ahead, brother.
Yeah, let's do it. I was going to say, speaking of trying to make sense of things that are sometimes patently nonsensical, let's get our guests out here. We're very, very thrilled to welcome the authors of the most hotly debated book in America right now. I don't think I'm out of bounds by saying that, called White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Everybody, Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman, bring them out here, Matt. Hey. There we are. Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. I'm Trey. That's Mark. I wanted to start by just saying, as a white from a tiny town in Tennessee with no traffic lights, jobs, or hope for the future, who is fueled by no small amount of rage, most of it impotent in nature, I just want to say, who the hell do you think you are out there talking shit about me and mine from your damn ivory towers on the coast, your big universities and stuff, huh? You think you're better than me? No, I'm kidding. But you guys probably get a lot of that, huh? I imagine, recently.
We have gotten a lot of that. And mostly from people who haven't read it, of course. That's not to mention the Nazis. We'll, you know, put them aside for now. There's a lot of them in my Twitter mentions if anyone wants to go and see. But yes, the reaction from people who have not actually read the book, which is actually subtle and nuanced and complex, although you might not know it from the title, it's been negative in some quarters. But, you know, we knew that was going to happen going in. I'll be honest, we didn't choose the title. That was something our publisher came up with, and they wanted to really hit it hard. And, you know, we knew it was going to be provocative, and so we tried to be ready for it. But it's been interesting, no doubt.
Yeah, no, that's something that people don't realize. When you write a book, I've written two books, not bragging. I know you guys have written 8 combined. I didn't pick the title of either of them. You know, like that's something that people don't know that publishers do that. And they want to make it as incendiary as possible. But I actually wanted to ask you guys, you sort of start the book by saying that Jason Aldean's mega smash hit, Try That in a Small Town, was a good example of the type of thing that inspired this book. As a massive hater of Jason Aldean and all he represents, I just wanted to ask if you guys would elaborate on that a little bit, how that inspired you. That song.
I know Tom has a lot to say, but I also know that he's going to let me talk about Jason Aldean because,
yeah.
I mean, okay, look, I don't have to. I don't want to tell anybody what to like or who to like. Anybody can like any artist they want. I do think, just as a matter of objective reality, that Jason Aldean is a purveyor of some of the most derivative, repetitive bro country. That just kind of Mad Libs, like dirt roads, pickup trucks. Dog in the back, cold beer. Let's just kind of mix and match it all around. Anyway, so the thing about the reason that we started telling the story of Try That in a Small Town was because it was so indicative of the moment. You know, it's not the first song like that. I mean, if you go back and you look at all the way back to Okie from Muskogee, Merle Haggard, you know, songs like Country Boy Can't Survive, Hank Williams Jr., Kiss My Country Ass. You know, there's been a lot of songs like this that have that kind of belligerent tone about how cities are dangerous. And here we are, you know, strong and good and honest people who also love guns. That's been a long history of that in country music. But it happens in 2022 or 2023, excuse me. And Jason Aldean comes out with this song and immediately some liberals start to criticize him for some of the racial undertones. You know, he said that didn't have anything to do with it. And he didn't know that that place that they shot the video once had a lynching. I believe that. I don't think anybody's accused Jason Aldean of having a subtle grasp of history. But in any case, it's all about this idea that like the city is dangerous and they're going to bring their mayhem here and we're going to meet it with violence. And it hits at a particular political moment when liberals criticize them and then Republicans like rush in and they're like, yes, this is the greatest thing ever. And they start playing it at their rallies. And the narrative around it is all like Jason Aldean is being canceled by the libs. Well, of course, he wasn't canceled. It was his biggest crossover hit of his career. Went to number one on the Billboard Hot 100.
Right.
So we thought that was kind of indicative of a lot of the issues that we are talking about. And that's why we led the book with that vignette.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. What bothered me about that song was like, you know, as somebody from a very small town, like, you know, Jason Aldean's from Macon, Georgia. They got like two targets or whatever. That ain't a small town. You know what I mean? And in the first verse, he's like, hijack an old lady at a red light. See what happens. I was like, a red light? What is this, Times Square? You know, so anyway, that's what bothered me about it, among many other things. But I'm sorry, Mark. I know you have plenty of questions, too. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, like, part of the big argument of the book is, like the disconnect between sort of – this is, like, the idea that, like the way small towns and people from small towns are talked about is, like, idyllic and noble. And I do want to say I did read the entire book because I'm a hardworking American from a rural community. And that's just like – we just get up in the morning, put our work boots on.
Read books. Like,
yeah, yeah. So the backlash. I bet someone's compared this to Hillbilly Elegy, and it's like, which is totally unfair. It's the thing I did, and I Googled it, and of course somebody had, and it was somebody who had tagged Matt saying to go talk to Matt about this instead. I guess he had to broker a ceasefire between you and some well-meaning activist lady, which all that is very funny to me. But the criticism on the right is like interesting to me because like basically, you guys. Like you'd be like, go like you're calling all rural Americans racist, which you're flatly not doing in the book. When in reality, are some of the hardworking, you know, salt of the earth people. It's like you're doing the exact thing we're talking about right fucking now. it's like you can't do any criticism because everybody in a small town is like perfect and noble or whatever. It's just a sort of insane way to live.
Yeah, well, a big part of the book is just trying to demystify this idea that some people are more real than others. And my take on this is stolen from my TV girlfriend, Tina Fey, from 30 Rock, who's my hero. second favorite comedian after you, of course, Trey. But a little pandering goes a long way, right? Yeah. So if you remember, there's an episode there where she talks about this whole idea about who's real or more real. And she's like, all Americans just want to have a sandwich and a diet Sprite and a quiet place to eat it for lunch. The sandwiches may differ, right? But that's essentially true. And I think when you say, okay, a 65-year-old white male, married veteran grandfather from Northwest Oklahoma is somehow more real than an Afro-Latina 22-year-old woman who's, you know, working at a cafe and Ubering around at night for extra money is somehow less than him, I think that's when you start down a bad path, right? When you start putting labels on people as less or more real. Now, there are some things about rural Americans. They do serve at higher rates in the military, and they should be applauded accordingly. Their patriotism, I don't think, is in question, and we don't question their patriotism in that showy way. Our criticism, and we appreciate you reading the book, by the way, Mark, because most of our critics didn't get past Rage. They got through the I don't even think they made it to the subtitle, many of the cases, but they, you know, what we're saying here is it's about commitments to democratic processes. It's about commitments to democratic norms. It's about commitments to a pluralistic, secular government and an inclusive society. And there, I think we make the case pretty strongly that, again, and every time, every statistic in there, we put a comparative statistic. We say that according to the Trevor Project, which studies gay rights and gay issues, that 49%, half of rural kids say that their communities are hostile to LGBTQ people, and it's only like 25 or 26% in cities and suburbs. So we don't say nobody in the suburbs thinks that their communities are hostile. One quarter of kids do, but it's 50% in rural America, and that's according to them. And so if you read the book, it's usually superlatives, most, highest, lowest. We don't say exclusively. And as you pointed out, we don't say every problem in America is exclusively white and rural. And we don't say everybody in white rural America. There's a lot of good white rural hippies. And we met some of them around. Mm-hmm. And they're just as liberal. In fact, they're more liberal than most of the guys I went to high school and college with in suburb of Albany. And certainly a lot of buddies of mine who got surprised this week because I was on a tweet list with a bunch of my fraternity brothers, most of whom are in Long Island, like Nassau County. They're sort of bridge and tunnel guys, first generation college guys. And they're like, Schaller. And they were, can I use dirty language on the podcast?
Yeah, please.
They're like, this pussy douche, how dare he, blah, blah, blah. And there's like a bunch of people who don't have my phone number. And I'm like, the pussy douche is right here, fellas. Let's go after it, you know? And it's like, I know that there are people that I've known for 15, 20 years who are offended by this argument, but I think it's an argument that needs to be had, and not just in rural communities. I think it needs to be had nationally.
Well, I mean, look, if somebody, again, first of all, I totally relate with what you just said about your buddies. So like this pussy, because same thing happened with me when I was like, hey, this, he's the redneck that everybody's listening to. You know what I mean? So I got a lot of that too. So I understand what you're saying, but I also like, I got a lot of, and still do sometimes get comments from people on the coast and stuff like that on some of my videos who say things like, you're like a unicorn, you know, like I didn't know you existed and that type of thing. And that makes you kind of defensive. You're like, no, it's not just me. There's more of me. We're not exactly legion, but we do exist. But having said that, me personally, I see the title of your book and I interpret it similarly to when like Chris Rock had a bit about rap songs or whatever, if they denigrate women or whatever. And they're like saying all this shit about hoes and people are like, he ain't talking about me. Right. That's sort of how I feel when I see the title. I'm like, oh, well, I'm one of the good ones. It's all right. You know what I mean? I don't interpret it personally, but a lot of people are going to do that regardless, just by nature of the fact that you guys are, I mean, that you are who you are, you know, you're academics and scholars and writers, and that means you're full of shit and you think you're better than them. I mean, that's just how they look at it, you know?
Well, I mean, we did share a plate of avocado toast and wash it down with a couple of cortados. And by the way, kale cheesecake, it's got a bit of an earthy dirt taste to it. Kale cheesecake.
Yeah.
Like, let me tell you, it's my favorite. I mean, if people, you know, if you can see the cultural insults that are leveled against me as like an out of touch elitist who's never been out of rural America. They obviously hadn't read the book. We've been to 5 rural communities in 5 different states in doing the research for this book. And I'm just as comfortable in the Round Robin Bar downtown at the Willard Hotel, where Martin Luther King finished the I Have a Dream speech, where Mark Twain lived for a residency, where Abraham Lincoln did his transition between his election in 1860 and his installation in March of 1861, maybe the most famous hotel in all of DC that's still standing. But you'd be surprised how comfortable I am in some absolute rural, you know, dive bar in the middle of the Adirondacks, where I've spent a ton of time in my life because I grew up in Albany and I love the Adirondacks. So it's just the sort of assumption, the ad hominem attacks, they get a little harsh. And if I showed you some of these hate mails, you'd be shocked. But it's when you stick your neck out, people are going to take a swing at you.
But you know, you're right, Trey. Like, if, yeah, oh, what I was going to say is, you know, if you look at voting patterns and maybe 70% or so of rural whites voted for Donald Trump in 2020. Well, that means that 30% of people didn't. And so, you know, if you're in a place where it's like 70-30 conservatives and liberals, that's still a lot of liberals. And even though they may feel outnumbered, and, you know, one of the things as we went around to different places, a lot of people told us, especially the liberals, they said that politics has really gotten meaner since Donald Trump came along. And it used to be that, you know, these fights, it wouldn't be that big a deal. And I get along with my neighbors. But since Trump, like now, I really feel like, you know, things are bad. And like one of the people we talked to was this librarian in Ashtabula County, Ohio, who ran for state representative. And she said that people would come up to her. She's a Democrat. She said people would come up to her and like literally whisper to her, like, I love you. I'm going to vote for you, but I can't take a sign because if I put it in my lawn, then my neighbor's going to take a shot at me.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the way a lot of liberals in rural America are feeling right now.
Mm-hmm. I want to, just rough numbers you guys are working with. So roughly 20% of America is rural, and only 3/4 of that is white. I say only 3/4 because people think 100% of rural America is white, and that's not remotely accurate. And you actually devote a whole chapter in your book about the experiences of, you know, different rural minority communities, and make the point that if you're talking about as a percentage of the population, the most rural communities are, I mean, like most Native Americans live rurally, as opposed to like, that's not just as true for white people, yada, yada. But like, you also make the point that like, when you take to those large populations and think about the way people react to like politics and public events, like you say in the book, if it was just about material concerns, why aren't rural Black people storming the Capitol?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, can I tell you why we wrote Chapter 7? We did it for a sincere reason and a strategic reason. The sincere reason is that they're 24% of rural America. You think they get 24% of the attention in the national media and the state media? My clever little line here is that the national media, since Trump came down on that escalator, has been climbing over each other like puppies trying to get out of a cardboard box to interview the next 10 rural white Trump red hat MAGA wearing people in some Southeast Missouri diner. But there are plenty of rural African Americans, Latino Americans, and of course, the nation's most rural population, Native Americans, and you don't see anybody sitting down to talk to them and meeting them where they're at. So they're entitled to some treatment. And frankly, 1 out of 8 chapters undersells that. We only gave them 1 out of 8, but we spent some time in places like the Albemarle region, where there's 7 counties clustered just south of the Virginia border on 95. They're on both sides. In fact, the first exit when you come south across the Virginia North Carolina border, it says Enfield, which is the county seat of Halifax County. And the mayor of that town, who came to my rural politics class tonight, is a guy named Mondale Robinson. And he has given me permission to share his story. This is a guy who started the Black Male Voter Project about 5 or 6 years ago to try to mobilize Black men, rural, urban, or suburban. And then he decided to put his own activism to test. He went back to his hometown of Enfield, the poorest city in North Carolina, and according to the sources we put in the book, the 8th poorest city in America. It's 2,200 people. It's majority Black. It is so downtrodden. We went there and Mondale was out of town, but like 90% of the storefronts are boarded up. And Mondale told us some of the storefronts, because the windows have been knocked out by birds or kids with rocks, there are trees growing in some of the storefronts downtown. And he is now running the city from back where he used to live here, and I don't want to say where, in the DMV area, because he's been doxxed and there's death threats, and the largest active chapter of the KKK is after him because he took down a Confederate statue there. Jesus. So he's literally mayoring the town from Maryland, 2 states away, because he and his wife saw guys with guns in their yard. This is what's happening.
When we talk about like centering white people in these conversations, there was interesting, I'm going to like how, what's the quote, like when you're used to like being preferential treatment, equality feels like oppression or something like that. But like, when like half the culture is telling them that you're awesome just because of your skin color and where you live, that you're a more noble person, you get up in the morning, go to work harder than everybody else, yada, yada, yada. But then when anybody criticizes you, it's like you get a huge backlash. And see, the right-wing media is great at generating this, where it's like, how dare they say this about you? But you couldn't like, I was thinking about your book and like the sheer number, the annoying number of books that are written by academics in the 90s and 2000s about like stuff that's broken or wrong in Black American culture or whatever. And the books, a lot of them were bad or dumb or whatever, but there was never this organized yelling at people about it. Like, even I agree with a lot of you guys said in the book, but even if you're wrong, it just doesn't deserve this amount. But it's just because people feel entitled to like an inherent respect. Like, does that make any sort of sense? Am I conveying that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of the rhetoric. You know, we always hear politicians talking about how we need small town values and how that's so important. And, you know, if you don't agree with that, then you hate people in rural America. And a couple of times people have brought up, you know, well, don't liberals just look down on people? Like, remember that thing Barack Obama said about people clinging to guns and religion? It's like, first of all, okay, he said that in 2008, 16 years ago, and people are still talking about it. One thing mm-hmm. he said, and if you look at what he actually said, he was right. He said that people here feel like neither party was doing anything for them. People kept telling them, oh, the jobs are going to come back. The jobs never came back. And so, yeah, now they are angry at both parties, and they look to issues like guns and religion to define their political identity because they've given up on any idea that Democrats or Republicans are going to do much for them. And the argument that we make is that is a huge gift to the Republicans because they don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about how Democrats have abandoned rural America, and a lot of places that's true. But Republicans have abandoned them too, because all mm-hmm. that's necessary for you to win if you're a Republican is you just walk in a couple days before election day and say, you know, don't you hate those elitist liberals back in the cities? And people say, yeah, and they vote for you. And then that guy leaves and he comes back 4 years later and does the same thing and doesn't do a damn thing to actually improve people's lives. And so, you know, the Republicans know that they don't have to. And so it's a huge gift to them to kind of remove economics and material concerns from what politics winds up being all about.
Yeah. I mean, you guys asked Congressman from Texas, Chip Roy, about like what his plan to help his rural constituents was. And he didn't even understand the question, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll tell that story. So we were reporting in Texas. We go out to see he's got this big district. It starts in the suburbs around San Antonio and Austin and stretches 150 miles west. And so we found out that he was going to do an event in this place called Hunt, Texas, which is unincorporated. Somehow at the one establishment in Hunt, which is this sort of restaurant slash store, they managed to get 50 or 60 people to come. So we go there. He kind of rolls in with a bunch of A's. They've all got these really nice matching embroidered white shirts with his name on it, an American flag and everything. And, you know, Chip Roy is a smart guy. And he gives them, you know, gives the people just sort of like a discussion of what's going on in Congress. And then he agreed to talk to us for a few minutes afterward. And one of the questions we asked him was, you know, you've got all these rural constituents. What, you know, what do they need? Do you have a, like a rural agenda that is particular to them? And he kind of looked at us like it had never even occurred to him. And then he said, what do you mean, like appropriations? And we said, well, it could be anything. And he said, well, you know, we started talking about how everybody cares about immigration. And then he went off on the farm bill, which they do every 5 years or so. And he doesn't like it because even though it gives a lot of subsidies to farmers, it also is where food stamps are funded. So he doesn't really like that. And in the end, like he had no answer. And just the fact that, you know, this is a guy who's a pretty prominent Republican. He's got he is never going to lose an election. His seat is gerrymandered so that, you know, he doesn't have to do a thing. And he's got all these rural constituents, and it hasn't even occurred to him that maybe they need something special that he could help them get.
Mm-hmm. And there's such a double standard here. Oh, go ahead.
There's
a double standard here, right? The Republican Party is never told that they need to go into urban America and talk to African Americans, the voters least likely to them, and sit and be respectful and not condescend, and then digest all that information and go back and cogitate for a couple of months and build a white paper or a massive plan, an 80-page report on how they're going to help solve the problems of African Americans in the city. Now, they talk about those problems all the time. You turn on Fox News and OANN and Newsmax every day, and you turn on talk radio, there's a talk radio, conservative talk radio host right now, either on live or on tape repeat, Maine to Maui, talking about cities and crimes and homelessness and thugs. So they're very interested in cities and crimes and the problems, and they blame the Democrats for it, okay? The Democrats, on the other hand, are expected to go to rural white America, their least likely voters,
right,
come and listen and show up in a Carhartt jacket,
right,
and really listen and try to reach their least likely voters. So the party that's won the popular vote 7 of the last 8 elections needs to try to appeal to its least likely voters. But the party that's lost 7 of the last popular votes, 7 of the last 8, doesn't have to do anything. And in fact, they're not only encouraged, they're rewarded for attacking. J.D. Vance, that little Pinhead. Yeah. I hate that guy. This is a guy who has been in New York City many, many times. He worked for a company that represented Purdue Pharma that poured all those opioids into his state and into his rural community.
Yep.
He goes to New York during the campaign for a fundraiser, and he goes, is it more like season one or season two of The Walking Dead? Implying that the city is in a zombie, flesh-eating apocalypse, you know, hellscape. But imagine Chuck Schumer says, I got to go do a fundraiser in the suburbs of Cincinnati. Do I bring my own methanol overalls or do the rural folks? He would be crucified saying something like that and trafficking in an unfair and wrong stereotype. But J.D. Vance doesn't lose any votes. He gains votes. Tell me that's a fair standard, or is that asymmetrical? What is it?
Right. So I wanted to add, like, you know, I've, again, as someone from this place, I've since the beginning of like the rise of Trump, and people were asking like, what the hell is going on here? Which, for the record, I still to this day have found it kind of wild that Trump became their champion, considering his background and everything about him. But I know you guys have something to say about that too. But first, from the beginning of the rise of Trump or whatnot, my position on this, like, people were talking about, like, what's going on with these white rural people and their love for Trump. I've always been like, well, look, they have very genuine grievances. They have good reason to be upset and to feel fucked over and left behind. Like, what has happened to my town is brutal and tragic, right? But they direct that anger in the wrong direction. They're not mad at the right people, from my perspective, and they don't hold anybody to account for actually fixing anything, and they just blame it all on the Democrats, like you guys were just saying. And I'm like, how did that happen? Why is it that easy? Why is it like all this bad stuff that can happen in my town, they just automatically blame the Mexicans, the liberals, and, you know, the coastal elites, instead of, you know, the corporate fat cats and everybody else that screwed them over the course of.
Well, that's the other double standard, right? It's after they do this very earnest piece on crime and homelessness on Skid Row in L.A., they go, the Democrats and the minorities and the white liberals who live in those cities and elect the politicians, the mayor and the city council should be held to account. Fine. That's what a representative government does. They should be held to account when there's problems in the cities. But what happens in rural America? There are hundreds of counties of our 3,000 counties that are more than 90% white and have fewer than 20,000 people. And those people are represented. The local elections may be nonpartisan, but everybody knows the school board and the sheriff, because 71% of sheriffs in the country in a poll identify as conservative. 95% of them are white and 97% of them are men. That's true. Okay, your sheriff and your superintendent, your county legislator and your county executive, your state assembly man, your state senator, your U.S. congressman, and your two U.S. senators, and when Trump and Pence were in white, are literally an entire chain of command from the Oval Office to the school board of not just Republicans, but conservative white male Republicans. And when something goes wrong there, what do they blame? The cities and Obama phones, right? So apparently, the representative form in our representative democracy, the Republican form, small r, is only held accountable to Democrats. But when anything goes wrong in right world America, none of that litany of conservative white Republicans are responsible for anything that happens in those small rural counties. That is a complete lack of accountability and responsibility. And it needs to stop, because our big recommendation at the end is not that they need to vote for Democrats, is that they got to get a better class of Republicans.
Yeah.
And period.
I want to say, so going back to JD, he's actually a good, like, because he writes Hillbilly Elegy. And the thesis of Hillbilly Elegy is like, oh, you don't need to feel bad for these people. They're all making terrible choices. Even my dumb whore mom slept around and got hooked on pills, right? And then when he starts running for office, he pivots to, actually, none of it's any of y'all's fault. It's all the illegals and globalists. And it's like, it, nowhere in there is any sort of political response or like action plan.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, you know, his book, if you read it, it is pretty brutal in some places. Yep. You know, he's talking about all the drug use and the violence, and he calls people lazy. And you're right. Then he decides, and he was critical of Trump. And then he decides, oh, I think I'd like to be a United States senator. So then he starts talking about how Joe Biden is bringing fentanyl into places like where I grew up to kill my family and your family. And, you know, it's clear he had a pretty good read on what people want to hear. And, you know, as you said, Trey, there are so many communities that really have suffered. You know, the manufacturing jobs went away. They've got healthcare problems. They've got mental health problems. They were targeted by the by the pharmaceutical companies in one of the most, you know, horrific crimes in American history. They just poured opioids into these places. And so I think a lot of people over time just decided that, you know, nobody's going to make this better. And I just want kind of an emotional satisfaction. And I think that's what Trump provided for people, is that even if he's not going to solve the problems, at least he'll tell me that he hates the same people I hate.
Right.
And he will not just say, like, we need to fix this. He will literally say, almost, you know, fuck those guys. Don't you hate them? And people, you know, shout and scream. And he also, you know, he also lied to them about what was going to happen. But I think in a lot of places, people knew it was a lie, but they wanted, it was what they wanted to hear. Like, I'll tell you an example. We did some reporting from Mingo County, West Virginia, which is really poor. It's coal country. I think the median income there is about $38,000 a year for a household. And Trump goes to West Virginia in 2016, and he literally puts on a hard hat and says, and I quote, "Get ready, all you miners, because you're going to be working your asses off." Well, guess what? He didn't bring the coal jobs back. When he came into office, there were 52,000 jobs in the entire U.S. coal industry. When he left, there were 38,000 jobs in the whole U.S. coal industry. There were more people working at Panda Express than in coal anywhere in America. And guess what? Well, did he lose votes? He did not.
Right.
In Mingo County, where, you know, it's one of the poorest places. They used to have coal, but, like, there's barely anybody working in coal there anymore. He got 83% of the vote in 2016. And then in 2020, after not bringing back the coal jobs and after not doing much to actually improve people's lives, he got 85% of the votes. So, you know, it's clear that people don't want to have any kind of strict accountability, but the emotional satisfaction that he gives them is something really powerful.
See, well, that's what I mean. That does seem to be what it comes down to, right? Is it's like, I mean, when he first got elected, when he won in 2016, I was, my naive ass initially was trying to be somewhat optimistic. And I was like, well, look, he told these people, he told my people everything they wanted to hear. And I know he's full of shit and he's not going to deliver on any of that. So maybe, you know, give him enough rope to hang himself, like let him prove that he's not going to deliver on any of that over the next 4 years. And maybe they'll see the light. That's what I was saying in 2016. And the opposite has happened, right? It's like you were just saying. And it really does come down to just that type of pandering towards like the culture war bullshit that they've all bought into, right? It's like the emotional satisfaction of just sticking it owning to the libs,
basically.
Owning the libs, right. And the libs are the bad guys. As long as he owns the libs, that's all that really matters, despite the fact that their lives continue to get worse actively because of him and his ilk's policies. Like,
not always their lives get worse. So, for example, when Barack Obama became president, 24% of rural Americans were uninsured. And Obamacare was passed in 2010, and 9 years later, by 2019, that 24% had been reduced to 16%. So that's 8% net. That's one out of 12 rural Americans who were uninsured when he took office were insured by the time he left. And since 8 is exactly a third of 24, that means it's a 33% reduction. One out of three rural uninsured had insurance by the time Obama left office. And yet, what did you hear? 52 times the Republicans in the House had put a language in a bill, including not even healthcare bills, calling for repeal and replace. Donald Trump ran on repeal and replace, and if it wasn't for John McCain, he would have got it. And now we know people like Jonathan Metzl, who's a doctor and has written about this, dying from whiteness, his book. The states that have adopted Medicare expansion, like Kentucky, they don't call it Obamacare. They call it Connect, K-Y-N-N-C-T, because Steve Beshear knows if you call it Obamacare, people would revolt. And then it's next door neighbor, Tennessee, which is one of only 10 states that still haven't adopted the Medicare expansion under Obamacare. The healthcare metrics are going in the opposite direction, even though these two states have very similar profiles, very similar economies, very similar black-white shares. And so Republicans are literally killing their own voters. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true.
And it's the rural voters. It's the rural voters most of all, too, because they're the ones who need that Medicaid expansion most.
No, you know, we were reporting in North Carolina has shut down twice in the past like 4 years, and it's currently shut down. It's shut down. They managed to get it back open, and now it's shut down again permanently. Like, we have no hospital in my hometown. It's because of what you guys are talking about, right? But
there have been hundreds of rural hospitals that have closed in recent years, and they absolutely depend on Medicaid, and they can't stay open without it. And then you have these states like Texas and Tennessee that refuse to accept the expansion of Medicaid at the expense of their rural constituents on whom they build their power. You know, we were reporting in North Carolina in that majority black area. We're talking to a county supervisor, and she said, you know, not only do we not have a hospital in this county, we don't have an urgent care center. Like, you got to get in your car and drive half an hour to get somewhere where you can get even the slightest bit of medical treatment if you sprain your ankle, let alone if you're having a heart attack. And so, you know, they finally approved the expansion in North Carolina after 10 years of fighting. But in those places, it's the rural people that Republicans take their votes and then refuse to give them something that is literally a matter of life and death.
And you know, you hear all this rural you should see the emails I get after all the kike, faggot, libtard insults. A lot of people just sort of want to make an ideological critique, and we don't want your socialism to take over. Oh, really? Socialism? So Social Security disability rates, is there higher dependency in rural America than in urban America and suburban America? Yes, there is. Are there 400 federal programs targeted to rural America, 70 at the USDA alone? Yes, there is. Do I begrudge that? Do I begrudge my taxes going there? No. Is there rising dependency on the earned income tax credit, which is for the people who basically make the minimum wage, or the children's tax credit? Yes. Is there rising homelessness, which we don't see because it's not in a little park in the city where there's government services, but it's people living in other people's garages in the loft there or on their couches and couch surfing because it's invisible homelessness, as all the homeless experts explain. It's rising. In fact, it's rising 12 times the rate. Now, granted, it's starting at a smaller number, but it's rising faster than urban homelessness right now. Rural people are hurting. We spend an entire chapter explaining that, and part of the race chapter explaining how non-whites are hurting as well. We want this problem to be fixed. Let me make another confession. I forgot to tell you about the strategic reason we wrote the race chapter, but let me make another confession. I wrote a book called Whistling Past Dixie. It came out in 2006, and I got harassed by Democrats. How do you abandon the South? How can you? We had the last three presidents, Bill Clinton, LBJ, and Carter, were from the South. And I said, Bill Clinton got 270 non-Southern electoral votes. You can build a coalition. And 2 years later, Barack Obama, a black man, did it. And I said, I'm right now, but I want to be wrong for the long term. I want states to start to turn. And Virginia did, and Georgia did. Paul and I want to be wrong about this book. We want to be wrong in the long term because we want people like Matt Hildreth, who's the producer of this show, to build a coalition that's pan-racial and pan-ideological, where white and black and brown brothers and sisters in rural America say, you know what? Enough of this shit. We're going to hold the Republican Party to account. And if they don't, we're going to join with the other side. And then both parties will be held to heel. And when there's a real fight between those two parties, then rural America get what it's need. And I'll apologize and retract the book in a decade if that happens.
I think one of the things that I found most like depressing in the book that I hadn't really thought about is, like, you guys say that the average age of a rural white American is 43, and 60%, something like 60% of people in rural white America tell their kids they should move away. Something like that. Is that right?
Yep. 60%.
That's considered. And there's other data in the book that, like, most people would like to live in, like, the idea that, like, people in the country look down on isn't quite accurate, considering most people would like to live in the country because they think of it as a nice place to live. So the two things are at such cross purposes.
Yeah, Paul, well, you know, tell them about Paul's got some great stories from Arizona.
So this is something that we heard everywhere we went, whether it was white people in West Virginia, Latinos in Arizona, Native Americans. Everywhere we went, people told the same story. They said there just isn't enough economic opportunity here. And somebody graduates high school and they're smart and they're ambitious and they look around and say, what am I going to do? Go work at the dollar store? I'm going to go out. Mm-hmm. You know, so for instance, we talked to this woman named Mila Besich in Superior, Arizona. And she said that when she graduated high school, her guidance counselor said to her, look, you know, the local copper mine is closing. There's not going to be any jobs around here. I'm going to help you get a scholarship, but you need to get out and don't come back. Well, she got out, she got a college degree, and then she did come back, and now she's the mayor. But we heard the same thing not a few hours away at an Indian reservation with a woman named Shauna Claw, who's now on the Navajo Council. She said she's got two kids. One of them's in the Air Force, lives in Seattle or wherever he's mobilized to. And the other one, she said she's going to be a cosmetologist, but we don't have a salon on the reservation. So she lives in Phoenix. And it's the same story over and over again that people just don't see enough economic opportunity. And the young people who have a lot to contribute, they end up leaving. And who does that leave behind? Well, it leaves behind older people and more conservative people. And then you get kind of caught in this cycle where, you know, some of these kind of political pathologies end up getting worse and worse.
And I was, and I'm sure Mark was too. Like, I was that kid in Salina in my hometown, you know, like, I made good grades and everything. And everybody universally, my family, you know, my parents, grandparents, my teachers, guidance counselor, everybody, their message was like, you've got a golden ticket. You can get out, you know, like you could use this to get out if you did. That was like the message that was sent to me. And then, so I did, I leave and I still have all this love in my heart for where I'm from. But it's like now people in my hometown think, you know, like that I, whatever, that I talk shit and make them look bad or I hate on them or whatever. And I have a negative opinion of the place or whatnot. It's like, well, I spent my whole life growing up being told to get the fuck away from there as soon as I possibly could. By every authority figure in my life, you know what I mean? Because it's just the reality in these places, you know.
You know, you know what's unfortunate for you guys? I assume you grew up in rural area too, Mark. Is people are going to reject us, right? I mean, I grew up in the suburbs. Paul grew up in northern New Jersey, and I spent a lot of time in rural America. All four of my grandparents spent their end years in living in rural America, not in some fancy house, right? But nobody's going to listen to us. You guys are arm's length. And the unfortunate thing about politics is nobody's going to listen to us because we're a football field away, but they will listen to you. And I think if you arm yourselves, which you have, I'm not criticizing you. I'm encouraging you and I'm trying to tell you not to get despondent. I think this conversation can be had, but it's really like one-to-one, peer-to-peer kind of stuff. Our book is probably going to, unfortunately, maybe move some people away and the reactionary. And if that happens, I'll feel sadly about that because that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to save the country in the short term from the brink of losing its democracy. But in the long term, we want people to live and to thrive and have great lives and livelihoods. And when you see, you know, mortality rates going up and life expectancies going down in some of these poor communities, 91% of gun deaths are white people in a country that's only 61%. And the states with the most liberal gun laws, you know, not liberal left, but have the most gun access is where the suicide rates are the highest. So, I mean, we're not trying to, you know, just trample on people who are already struggling. We want them to be uplifted. And we're writing a book that I think is maybe painfully honest and maybe does have a provocative title, Guilty as Charged, but we think needs to be out there.
You guys like, see, I didn't, so the backlash of the book's been weird to me because like you guys are not talking down to people at all. Like you treated people like they're responsible adults who have agency and can make different choices. And like you said, you don't even tell them to vote Democratic. You're making your point is like the way our political system's rigged, it's rigged so rural people have all this power because of gerrymandering, every state having two senators, gerrymandering both in the state legislatures and in Congress.
Right.
If you got organized, you could ask for legitimate material changes. You could get your potholes fixed and get Medicaid expansions. You could like make it so my mom doesn't have to drive, like wait 2 months to get a doctor's appointment when she needs an antibiotic. Do you know what I'm saying?
go ahead, Paul.
And so our argument is that they have all this power that, but the only use to which it's being put is to make sure Republicans keep getting elected. And, they could use it for something better for themselves. And that's why we say that rural people need a rural movement, one that's really expansive. Because if you think about it, you know, they are one of the core elements of the Republican coalition and every other element of both parties' coalitions. They got a set of demands. You know, if a Republican gets elected president, they got to sit down with the gun advocates and big business and evangelical Christians, and they've all got an agenda. And they all say, this is what we want. You need to, you know, keep talking to us. Your entire 4 years you're in the White House, we've got legislation we want you to pass. We've got all these things we want you to do. And if you don't do it 4 years from now, you might not get the help that we gave you this last time. And rural Americans form one of the core foundations of the Republican Party, and they have no demands. They're not even sitting at that table. And so why should Republicans bother to make any kind of changes that might actually change their lives?
And who's more insulting? There's an old saying in D.C. that in D.C. people stab you in the front. They look you right in the eye with a nice smile and jab it right between your ribs. So who's more insulting? Us, me and Paul, who are telling you some hard truths, or Ted Cruz, who represents a state that has the most counties, 254, the vast majority of which are rural, and many of them, not all of them, are 80, 85, 90% white. When Ted Cruz goes on and says, my pronouns are kiss my ass. What he is saying is that all I got to do is this performative politics, and these gullible morons are going to vote for me. And I'm sorry to use that language, but that's his view of it. He's sitting in Joe's Steakhouse, which is where I saw Mark Meadows 6 months after January 6th sitting one table over, right? Eating a $65 ribeye. and a $20 cocktail. And Ted Cruz is laughing because he's like, I don't have to deliver a damn thing for these people. All I got to do, then a year later, he did this whole thing about they're trying to limit me to 2 beers. And you know what I say to those people? They can kiss my ass. Ted Cruz wants people's faces in his ass, which I think is weird. and by the way, there's a lot of homoerotic stuff right on the right. Like you see the Trump flag. Colin Kaepernick is disrespecting the flag, but you go to a Trump rally and there's a U.S. flag with Trump's face with the Rambo bandana and then superimposed on the Rambo nude torso from 1985, right?
Yeah.
And that's like, as Tina Fey said, gayer than the volleyball scene in Top Gun. And then, of course, for all the criticism of drag queens, we know from John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor who meets with the president every day, except he's golfing, that Donald Trump spends 25 minutes a day on his makeup and 90 minutes on his hair. That's almost 2 hours. That's more time than my niece has spent getting ready for the prom. And there's only two kinds of men in America who spend 2 hours a day getting ready for their big performance, Donald Trump and drag queens.
Before you go, one of the things I was really excited to ask you about, because it's a personal hobby horse of mine, was truck commercials. All right. Wow. I have ranted about truck commercials on this show so much, and to see my own take reflected back at me, like, it was smart. I just wanted to say thank you. Please give me your take on truck commercials, please.
Oh, I find pickup trucks so fascinating. Once I started to delve into this, it's just like I'm seeing this everywhere. It's a real way that kind of these notions of rural masculinity that have really disappeared in people's actual lives still get expressed through trucks. So, do you know what the three most best-selling vehicles in America are? The Ford F-150, the Chevy Silverado, and the Ram pickup. Every single year, and fewer people need to actually pick stuff up. They're not towing and hauling. And these things now, they used to be kind of a mark that you maybe were a laborer. You know, you were like a blue collar person, and now you go to some places like we reported from the Hill Country of Texas. You know, we had a rental car. I think sedans may be illegal in that area of the state. Every single car on the road is a pickup, and they are just gleaming. And there are models of the F-150 that start around $85,000. This is a luxury vehicle, but it's being sold through all those commercials as something where you can get that piece of masculinity. You know, you can haul and tow and be like that famous Super Bowl commercial that used the Paul Harvey thing about God made a farmer. You can be a little bit like that farmer. Now, less than 1% of Americans are farmers now, but you could be a little bit like that farmer. You can be strong and capable and compassionate and competent and all those things that we associate with rural masculinity. And all you got to do is to spend $100,000 on this really nice truck.
And then complain about economic anxiety and gas prices, right? In the next
Also, what happened to like light pickup? Like if a Toyota light pickup is good enough to help the Taliban defeat the U.S. military, I think it's good enough for the rest of us to haul a little hay around or whatever.
I got to say, you know what I've got my eye on is that Ford Maverick. It's a small pickup. They should make more of those. And it comes in a hybrid because I'm a Northeastern liberal elitist. And that's what I want. Ford
there
Maverick.
You go.
I want to point you. You just mentioned the Sam Elliott narrated truck commercials, and I thought like you missed an observation there that I just wanted to point out to you. That Sam Elliott, like it's sort of like a meta thing that sort of drives the point home. Sam Elliott has made his living as an actor playing a cowboy and voicing truck commercials about how tough it is to be a cowboy and get up. Sam Elliott is from fucking Portland, Oregon. I just want to say that.
Right. And some of your smart, I've been watching the comments. You got some smart followers on this. I'm saying that, and that's not pandering. They said Jason Aldean's from a big town. You know who's from a small town of 7,000 people in North Georgia? Little Nas X, right? He's more rural than there Jason Aldean and Kid Rock, who was born in the suburbs to like a rich car dealer.
Car dealership owner. Yeah.
Yeah. Rural rock. They're posers, man. And, you know, Elise Stefanik is my personal little thing because I live in upstate New York and I spend a lot of time. One of your viewers said they just climbed Whiteface Mountain a couple weeks ago, which is insane in the middle of the winter. They call them winter 46ers. There's 46 peaks above about 4,000 feet. I've got 23 of them about halfway there, including Whiteface. And Elise Stefanik, I know a lot about her. She grew up in Albany. I grew up in Albany. I went to Bethlehem Central Public School. She went to Albany Academy for Girls where they wear uniforms and it's $10,000 a year or whatever it was when she's there. I went to SUNY Plattsburgh, got kicked out, finished at a SUNY Oswego because I had two siblings behind me that my parents were trying to put through college. she went to Harvard, right? And then she worked for Paul Ryan in Washington. And then she decides to run, and the district that's available is up in the Adirondack North Country. And so she runs from her home in Willsboro, which is her parents' second summer home. Now, imagine if I had did that. Imagine if I had gone to a private school and Harvard and ran for my parents' summer school as a liberal Democrat. They would have crucified me. But it's okay for her.
Yeah. You know what?
Poser, carpetbagger.
You fuckers are all right. You know, that's my like a lot of people
sell
saw the
reaction.
And I know how titles work with books, like I said, but still I saw the book title and again, I couldn't help it. I was like, I don't know how this is going to go, but I like you guys. So on that note, thank you so much for joining us. Before you go do that, sell the book, tell them where they can get the book, where you want them to get the book, and leave any parting thoughts.
You can go to whiterurlrage.com and it has the links to every seller from Amazon on down. So just buy it where it's cheapest because there's a lot of variety there. Pay as little as possible.
Right on. Love it. All right. Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman, thank you guys so much. We appreciate
it. Thanks, fellas.
See y'all next time. All right, skewers, that was it. That was fun, right? I liked it. I hope you liked it too. We're out of time. We're going to get out of here, but I want to remind you real quick, go to treycrowder.com, get your tickets, come see me out there on the road, and support the show on Patreon, weeklyskews.com/more, or look my name up on Patreon, get some more skews in your life and support the show in the process. Main thing is you keep watching this here main show and we'll keep doing it. We'll see you next skews day. Love you. Bye.
Pew.